Welcome back to PedScript. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
Alice, will you remind our listeners what we do here at PedScript?
Absolutely. PedScript is an educational PICU podcast. We are looking for the best teaching spiels we could find, and we are putting them in the podcast apps for you.
And we are very excited to share this topic today. What are we talking about?
Yes. Today, we are talking about temporary cardiac pacing. These are the kids that in the CI who come out of their cardiac surgeries with temporary wires, and we're going to talk about how to pace them. Zach, who are we talking with for this episode?
Today, we are very excited to be speaking with Dr. Eric Silver. Dr. Silver is an associate professor of pediatrics at Columbia University. He completed his cardiology fellowship there at Columbia and his EP fellowship at Stanford. He is, of course, a board-certified EP specialist there at Columbia. He is very active in EP-related research and education, and he is a fantastic guest for us to have on the show today to discuss this topic.
Yes, and we are super grateful for Gav Apfel for recruiting him and for thinking of the idea to do this episode. Gav is the future cardiac intensivist on the team. He is currently a CI hospitalist at Columbia University, and he will be joining their critical care fellowship program next year.
That's right. Let's get right to the content. Welcome back to the podcast. We are so excited to be talking about this very important topic with Dr. Eric Silver and Dr. Gav Apfel. Welcome to the podcast.
Great. Thanks for having me.
To get things started, Eric, will you please share with us something about yourself and include something you enjoy outside of medicine?
Sure. I grew up in New York. I have three kids. Most of my activities are tied around chasing my kids around in sporting events and teams and driving them to and from places. So that's my life outside of work.
Oh, nice. What do they play?
Basketball, baseball, tennis, soccer, golf. That's about it.
Oh my gosh.
Nice. Very athletic. Gav, we learned last time about your barbering skills. Anything else to share today?
I'm definitely not as athletic as Dr. Silver's kids.
I didn't say
school.
They were athletic. I said they play a lot of
sports. They're participating, though.
I was captain of a chess team. And
oh, that's amazing.
Let me tell you, there were a lot of crazy injuries in that sport.
Lots of mental sweat, awesome. I bet. Yeah. Alice, right. You want to give us our second question?
Eric, how did you become interested in pediatric EP? And what are your current areas of research or professional involvement that you'd like to share?
I became interested in pediatric cardiology just because kids are fun, and cardiology seemed to be a very interesting way to meld taking care of sick kids and taking care of healthy kids and watching them grow over time, and very interesting physiology. And then once I started my fellowship, I just gravitated towards EP. It's kind of the thing that a lot of cardiologists are even intimidated by, and I just got comfortable with it. I found it was interesting. We can fix a lot of things. We can help families deal with things that we can't necessarily fix, and always new groundbreaking techniques to learn and a lot of lifelong learning stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you mentioned this is intimidating, and it certainly is intimidating for critical care fellows. So Eric, as ICU fellows who are really have very limited experience with EP, what advice would you have, like maybe learning tools or things to learn more of these fundamentals of EP as we approach our next rotation in the cardiac ICU or as we prepare for an attending job?
Yeah, I always find that to be a tough question. I mean, there's a million different things you can try and read, and nowadays there's lots of different sites and things like educational things like this. But a lot of it's just honestly at the bedside, just hanging out when the cardiologists are around and trying to pick up what they're doing. Anytime they're checking temporary pacemakers, join them and see what they're doing and make sure I understand why they're making adjustments and what it all means.
Very fair.
Great. Gav, you want to give us our case?
All right, we have a 2-year-old, previously healthy girl who has a VSD, who is admitted to the CICU after undergoing repair of her VSD. Shortly after arriving to our unit, the patient's heart rate drops to the 70s, her blood pressures become a little softer, and then you notice that on telemetry, it seems like the P waves and the QRS complexes are no longer following each other in synchrony. You recognize that the patient is in complete heart block. Now, it seems like this is not uncommon in our units, and it seems like virtually a lot of the patients who come back from surgery come back with pacing wires in place just in case things like this happen. Can you speak to some of the common indications for acquiring temporary pacing in post-op patients?
Well, you mentioned one of them. Heart block is probably the most common reason why we're pacing patients. Other indications would be junctional bradycardia. So in somebody who had surgery and their sinus node isn't working very well, junctional rhythm is pretty well tolerated in general, but right after surgery where you're having a lot of hemodynamic effects from recovering from the surgery, it's kind of a tough time. Junctional tachycardia also, if we're trying to control, we can use medicines to try and slow things down, but we often will atrial pace in order to provide AV synchrony. This is consistent heart block that you're describing, but sometimes patients have intermittent heart block. We might put backup pacing in place in order to make sure that if they get very bradycardic, that the pacemaker won't allow that.
As we move forward in the post-op course, I feel like usually they come back with pacing wires. We may or may not get an atrial EKG, and then we might want to do some preventative things with the pacer, right?
So other uses for pacing wires. So pacing wires can be great for pacing in patients who have either sinus node dysfunction or heart block, but also they could be useful for diagnosis. So sometimes we don't see the P waves very clearly, either because they have sinus rhythm and maybe their PR interval is long and the P waves are on top of the T waves and they're just hard to see, or they may have junctional rhythm and we just can't tell if it's junctional rhythm. So you can hook up the atrial pacing wire to one of the leads on the EKG. Usually we'll pick one of the V leads, one of the chest leads. As we run the EKG tracing, that'll show us a big spike that corresponds to the P wave, so it's much easier to see them. We also use pacing wires for therapy for somebody who has an atrial arrhythmia, like atrial flutter or other forms of SVT. We can often pace the atrium at a rate faster than the atrium is going in order to try and interrupt the circuit to try and put them back into the normal rhythm.
All great comments so far. Just to summarize quickly, you mentioned a number of indications for pacing in the postoperative patients. You mentioned AV block, of course, like our case, but junctional tachycardia, jet, and even intermittent AV block. And then uses for this pacemaker outside of just regular pacing can be used diagnostic if you can't identify the P wave on the EKG, or therapeutic overdrive pace, as you mentioned. I think it might be helpful for our listeners maybe who don't have as much exposure in the CICU. Let's actually get to the nuts and bolts. Like, what are the components of the temporary pacemaker? Where are these wires going?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the surgeons at the end of the surgery are sewing wires onto the outside of the heart. These are temporary wires that are designed to be able to be removed very easily. So they're kind of loosely attached. It's one of the reasons why they don't always work all that well. And sometimes they work for a period of time, and then over the course of a few hours or days, they may stop working. But the surgeon will sew them on. They'll come out through the skin, and then you'll be able to access the other end of them. Pacing is sending an electrical signal to the heart to capture the heart, to activate the heart. So if the lead or the wire is attached to the atrium, if you're pacing, you'll be able to capture the atrium. So you can pace the atrium at a faster rate than it's going. If the wire is attached to the ventricle, you can pace the ventricle. So you're sending a signal through one of the wires, and then you'll notice there's two wires that go to the atrium and two wires that go to the ventricle. That's because when you send a signal, it's got to come back to the pacemaker. It has to have a complete circuit. So you send it through one wire, and then it returns back through the other wire. The one you're sending it through has to be attached to the heart. So if you're pacing the atrium, it has to be touching the atrial tissue. If you're pacing the ventricle, it has to be touching the ventricular tissue. But the other one doesn't have to be touching that chamber. It just has to be touching the body somewhere. So you can use the other wire, which is the ground, if it's attached to anywhere on the patient. So occasionally we'll put a skin lead on, we'll attach something to the skin, and we'll use that as our ground. It really just has to be touching the patient. And it's one of the reasons that if the pacemaker is not working very well, the first thing we think about doing is switching the pins, right? We'll unplug both of them and plug them back in on the other side, because maybe one is pulled off the heart and it's not touching the heart very well, and the other one might still be. And maybe you're just pacing from the wrong one, and it might be more effective if you switch the pins and pace in the other direction.
That's great. So what I'm hearing is there aren't as many differences in EP as there are troubleshooting audio recording equipment. Just unplug it and plug it back in.
Sounds about right.
Sorry, just to clarify. So there is no situation where you'll have just one A wire and one V wire. It'll always have to be a pair of each.
Well, you have to have at least one touching the heart. There are times where surgeons might put one on, but it's not really that helpful because you need another wire attached to the patient. So if you just have one wire attached to the ventricle, you can put a skin lead on and use that as the ground. Or if you have a wire touching the other chamber, you can use that as your ground. And when you plug these in, if you pay attention as you're screwing the wires into the little electrical cable, one side says positive, one side says negative. The negative pole is the pacing pole. The positive one is the ground. So if you ever put a skin lead on, you have to attach that to the positive pole. If you attach it to the negative pole, it's not going to work.
I see. Thank you. That was really helpful.
Sometimes when I look at these babies in the post-op period, tiny baby, you have all kinds of wires and cords everywhere. I feel like usually one cord kind of comes out to the right, one's on the left, they're different colors. Is there some convention that we should be aware of to know which is the atrial, which is the ventricular wires?
Yeah, yes and no. Every center may have their own convention. In general, most places will have the atrial wire coming out on the right side and the ventricular wire coming out on the left side. So that is, even if you have dextrocardia, heterotaxy, your heart's in the wrong place, any of those things, the surgeons, at least at our institution, will try to consistently put the atrial wires on the right and the ventricular wires on the left. There's no hard and fast rule. Other centers may do it differently, but generally, I think most centers try and follow that. The problem with that is they do that, and then they put dressings all over, and sometimes they get twisted underneath the dressing, and it looks like one is coming out on one side, but actually it's coming out of the patient on the other side. So we've been fooled occasionally. Some centers try and use the colors of the cables to try and help guide things also, but you're relying on whoever hooked up the cable, so that doesn't necessarily work either. So if I have any question, I'll usually try and track it back to the dressing and see if I could tell where it's entering the skin, and the one on the right should be the atrium. When you hook it up to the pacemaker, if you're trying to pace and it seems like it's capturing the other chamber, though, then you should consider whether you should use the other one and see if that one's the correct one.
So a lot of times we'll get a kid back from surgery, and in sign out, they'll have told us that we need to pace AAI or DDD or VVI. Can you just go over the basics of what these three-letter acronyms stand for? How do they represent different pacing modes?
Yeah, absolutely. So pacemakers, the algorithm uses a three-letter code. Pacemakers are designed for pacing, right? The most important thing is pacing. So the first letter corresponds to what chamber is being paced. So the things you'll see are A, V, or D. A means you're pacing the atrium, V means you're pacing the ventricle, D means you're pacing both the atrium and the ventricle. Occasionally you'll see O. That's on a permanent pacemaker. That's essentially if you want to shut off a permanent pacemaker. But we don't see that on a temporary pacemaker. Atrium means you're pacing the atrium, ventricle means you're pacing the ventricle, and D means you're pacing both the atrium and the ventricle. The second letter is what chamber is being sensed. It has the same three options. You could either sense the atrium, sense the ventricle, or sense both the atrium and the ventricle. And in truth, you can sense neither if you want to, but we rarely do that, so we'll skip over that for the moment. And the third letter is what the pacemaker does when it senses something, how it responds to a sensed event. So that can either be I, meaning that it's inhibited. It could be T, meaning it's triggered, but we never just do triggered, so you'll never see T by itself. So it's either I or it's inhibited and triggered, which is what we call D, so dual. So if the pacemaker is only pacing the atrium and sensing the atrium and being inhibited, if the pacemaker sees that the heart rate is going at a reasonable rate, it'll be programmed AAI, right? The ventricle is the same way. If ventricular rate is at 60 and you program somebody VVI at 50, that means it has the ability to pace the ventricle, but it's sensing the ventricle. And if the ventricular rate is faster than 50, it will inhibit the pacemaker. I always tell people, inhibit is not inhibiting the patient. There's nothing the pacemaker can do that can stop the patient's heart from beating, right? It's entirely inhibiting what the pacemaker is doing. And DDD is the more complicated one because it's an interaction between atrium and the ventricle. So it has the ability to pace both the atrium and the ventricle. It also has the ability to sense both the atrium and the ventricle. And it can be either inhibited or triggered by what it sees. So if it sees that the patient has sinus rhythm with a P wave and a QRS that's working normally, the pacemaker will be inhibited from pacing both the atrium and the ventricle. If the pacemaker sees that there's a P wave and then it's waiting and doesn't sense a QRS, then it can be triggered to pace the ventricle in response to that P wave. And a lot of this depends on how you set settings on the pacemaker. So if you tell it to wait a certain period of time before it paces the ventricle, if you tell it not to wait very long, then even though the AV node might work, it just might pace before the conduction actually would have happened.
Nice. So pace, sense, response, PSR, what it's pacing, what it's sensing, and then what the response is.
Right, exactly.
Can we talk about when we would use the different types, especially in these epicardial pacing situations, like when to use AAI versus VVI versus DDD?
Sure. So AAI is if a patient has junctional rhythm, whether it's slow junctional rhythm or relatively fast junctional rhythm that you're trying to pace a little bit faster to try and provide AV synchrony. As long as the AV node works, but you either have a sinus rate that's too slow or a junctional rate that's too slow, you would want to pace the atrium so that you can have the atrium go first instead of the junction. And that way they'd restore AV synchrony. If you're really just providing a backup, then VVI is the best option because you can just say, don't allow the heart rate to get less than whatever number you pick. Ideally, if the patient has heart block, you want to program them DDD because you're trying to replace what the AV node function normally would. So you want the pacemaker to be able to sense the atrium and then wait, and if there's no conduction, pace the ventricle, pretty much reestablishing what the AV node would be doing. It's fairly often for the atrial wires not to work all that well, though. So there are plenty of times that we're pacing VVI in somebody who has complete heart block just because we can't get the atrial wires to sense appropriately.
That's fair.
just to recount, because it seems so clinically important, if you have a patient who's in junctional rhythm, AAI should be appropriate for them because their AV node should work. If you just want a ventricular backup rate, VVI is generally the way to go. But if you have a patient who has AV block, you still like the atria and the ventricles to be in synchrony, so you would use DDD.
Exactly.
Great. So our next question, we have this patient coming back to us from the OR. What should we listen for in surgical sign out to think about if this patient may be at higher risk for arrhythmias post-op?
Yeah, so there are some pre-op factors that you'd want to consider. There are certain cardiac diagnoses that are associated with conduction issues. So patients with heterotaxy have a higher chance of having AV nodal dysfunction. Patients with L-looped ventricles or congenitally corrected transposition or LTGA, a bunch of different names for the same issue, have a higher incidence of having AV nodal disease. And they can have surgery that's nowhere near the AV node and they can come out with heart block. So anyone who has any of those underlying disorders, you'd want to consider them at a higher risk. And you may be inclined to put them on a ventricular backup pacing, even if they haven't had conduction issues. Anyone who has a history of either conduction issues or arrhythmias, that should get your attention. Anyone who's been on antiarrhythmics for any reason because of a history of arrhythmias, or who had conduction issues at a prior surgery that recovered, all those things would be red flags that you might be expecting somebody to have a higher chance of having issues during this post-op course. And things that happened in the OR are sometimes really difficult for the anesthesiologist to sort out. They're busy doing other things. They're not focused on the monitor the way the cardiac electrophysiologist or the cardiologist really is focused on it. And they often have things going by in real time, and they glance up and they see that the patient's bradycardic or tachycardic. But to expect them to really know what the arrhythmia might have been, they may, but it's asking a lot to really expect that anything they tell you to necessarily be correct. So I always listen carefully, but I always take whatever they say with a grain of salt, knowing that it's not necessarily the case that whatever they say they saw is what actually happened.
Sure. It makes sense that any kind of pre-morbid disease with arrhythmia issues would certainly put you at greater risk post-operatively. Does length of bypass run or aortic cross-clamp time really contribute to this at all?
It really doesn't contribute to the risk of arrhythmias. Sometimes patients who have a harder intraoperative course may be at a higher risk of having something like a junctional tachycardia. But there are plenty of patients who have a really tough intraoperative course and don't have any arrhythmias, and the converse. The way I think about it is the sicker you are coming out, the less likely you are to tolerate any arrhythmias. So you may be watching them more carefully to make sure that you're on top of any arrhythmias very quickly. But it's not necessarily that the risk of having arrhythmias would be that much different.
Are there any particular surgical repairs with sutures and patches in certain areas of the atrium or the ventricles that would put one at higher risk for a certain type of dysfunction or arrhythmia?
For heart block, certainly. If you're operating anywhere near the AV node, then your risk of having conduction disease coming out of the surgery is going to be higher. If you go into the surgery with a right bundle or a left bundle, your risk of having heart block after surgery is going to be higher. And there are certain diagnoses that we know that are associated with a higher risk, and certain surgical procedures that we know are associated with a higher risk of getting permanent or temporary heart block.
I'd be interested to know what those surgeries are.
Yeah, it's really anything that involves a VSD, but mitral valve replacements, things like a double switch surgery, anything where there's a lot of sutures being placed in the area of the AV node, especially in patients with heterotaxy or patients with LTGA as an underlying abnormality, would be at a high risk.
Great. Alice, you want to give us our case update?
Yes. So you've got a 2-year-old who comes back from their VSD repair and complete heart block. You successfully program the pacer to DDD at a backup rate of 110. Her vital signs quickly improve. You continue night rounds. A few hours later, you are called to the bedside again for resumed bradycardia to the 70s. You notice on her telemetry, you can no longer see pacing beats and now see long pauses intermittently in between some of the QRS complexes. In this scenario, how are we troubleshooting the pacemaker?
All right, so we're going to broaden that question and make it just troubleshooting in general. And before I do that, I just want to say one other thing. So you said DDD with a lower rate of 110. So DDD means that you're sensing the atrium and pacing the ventricle, right? But DDD comes with two numbers. There's 110 and there's going to be a second number afterwards, right? The second number is how fast is the pacemaker allowed to pace? Our AV nodes behave like this. If you have atrial flutter and your atrial rate is 300, your AV node is not designed to keep up with that, right? That would be dangerous to have your ventricle going at 300 beats a minute. The same way when we program a pacemaker, we tell it what upper limit we're allowing it to pace the ventricle at. And that would be different for a 2-year-old than it would be for a 15-year-old. So we want to pick a upper tracking rate that's appropriate for the patient's age. That doesn't necessarily mean they can't have a sinus rate faster than that. If I pick 180 and the patient has a sinus rate of 190, that's possible. But it's just making sure that if they have atrial flutter at 240, that they're not going to conduct one-to-one using the pacemaker. We run into problems with the upper tracking rate all the time. That is one of the more common troubleshooting issues, but we could talk about that in a moment. Let me answer your question first. So you come to the bedside, you were DDD pacing, your lower rate was set at 110, you said, and now the heart rate is 70. So there's really two potential issues. One is that it is trying to pace and not capturing, or one is that it's a sensing issue where it's getting confused by what it's seeing and it's not trying to pace when it should be trying to pace. So as far as not capturing, that either means you're not pacing with enough energy, right? So either the amount of energy needed to capture the heart has changed, either because they're sicker, they're acidotic, they moved and the wire got tugged, or the cable came loose. So the first thing I would do is turn up the amount of energy, just crank it up, use plenty of juice to try and capture the ventricle. And I also check all the wires, right? So I'll make sure everything's plugged in well, because sometimes something's come loose. That is while I'm looking at the monitor to try and see if it's pacing and not capturing. If it's not pacing, then it's going to be a sensing issue. Sensing is a little harder to try and talk through. And when I do this with my fellows, we do these all the time where we sit there and talk through it. And I'm going to talk you through it and it's going to make sense, I think. And then you're going to walk away and it's not going to make sense anymore. So it's the kind of thing that you kind of have to think about over and over again. And the easiest analogy that I've heard that I use is thinking about sensing like a fence. We program the height of the fence, and basically we're trying to allow the pacemaker to see things off in the distance. We want it to be able to see a P wave if we're trying to sense the atrium. So if we program the fence too high, the pacemaker is not going to be able to see that P wave, right? That is insensitive. So a high number is an insensitive setting. So if we want to make it more sensitive, we have to turn down the number or lower the fence in order to allow the pacemaker to see it. It's kind of counterintuitive. We want to make it more sensitive, the number has to be lower. The problem with making it too sensitive, though, is it may see other things other than the P wave, right? It may see the ventricle depolarizing, even though you don't want it to. So if you make it too sensitive, it's going to start to see things it's not supposed to. When you hear the terms undersensing and oversensing, undersensing means that it's not seeing things that it should see. And if it's undersensing, then it's going to pace when it shouldn't pace, because it didn't realize you had a P wave, so it's going to pace the atrium right after that. Or it may not pace when you want it to pace if it's DDD, because it didn't know there was a P wave. It doesn't know it's supposed to pace the ventricle. So if you notice that it seems to not be sensing appropriately, which is not always so easy to do at the bedside, but the easiest way generally is glancing down at the little light flashes on the pacemaker. And if you see like the atrial sensing seems to be not sensing very often, then it may be undersensing. It may be not seeing P waves that it should see. And if that's the case, you would want to make it more sensitive. So you'd want to lower the number. If it seems like there's a whole bunch of flashes all over the place on the atrial lights, then it may be oversensing. You may want to make it less sensitive. The other thing that sometimes tricks things up is we've talked about the upper tracking rate. When patients come from the OR, often the anesthesiologist turn on the pacemaker and plug in the wires, and things are working great, and they just kind of leave the settings as they are. But when you turn on a pacemaker, it's really designed for an adult, and the upper tracking rate is relatively low. Let's say 130 beats per minute. So that's fine if their sinus rate is 110. But if the sinus rate goes up to 150, the pacemaker is not allowed to pace the ventricle at 150. So in order to get around that, the pacemaker will purposefully wanky bock. It's a designed wanky bock, which is good if the heart rate is too fast and you want to prevent it from pacing the ventricle at a really fast rate. But if it's set inappropriately, then you would want to turn up the atrial rate or turn up the upper tracking rate, allow it to see the atrial rate that's going faster. So if you take that same patient and you turn up the upper tracking rate from 130 to 170, now you'll see that you fix the sensing issue. Now it's not having trouble seeing things. It's not undersensing, and it'll pace the ventricle in response. But for a long answer to a short question, if you see that the heart rate is 70, when you set it with a lower rate of 110, that very likely means that it's trying to pace and not capturing. And you'd want to turn up the output. You'd want to make sure all the plugs are good. And you'd want to be thinking about things to try and support the heart rate if they're really too bradycardic, if your pacing wires are really not working.
That was great. So because this is such a key point, let me try to read this back to you and make sure I'm on the same page. So we have this patient, they're bradycardic relative to where we have their set rate. Several things can be happening. One of the things that you mentioned is failing to capture. Essentially, the energy the pacemaker is delivering to the patient is not causing depolarization, not causing contraction. Number of things that can cause that. Maybe the patient's sicker, more acidotic. They're not as sensitive to that energy. Maybe the wires come out of the pacemaker box. Maybe the wire's been displaced from the child's pericardium. There's a number of things that can happen there. One potential way around that won't solve everything is to increase the output and to make sure the wires are correctly plugged into the pacemaker box. Fair so far?
Yes.
Another potential issue is maybe the pacemaker's under-sensing. And you talked about how we should think of sensing as essentially like a fence, where if the sensing number is too high, that's like having a very high fence where the pacemaker can't detect subtle atrial contractions or depolarizations. If we want to increase the sensitivity of the pacemaker, we actually would bring that number down, and that might allow the pacemaker to detect those atrial depolarizations at the cost of maybe it will respond to things that aren't real atrial contractions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and the other thing I'll say is I said before that the wires are barely attached to the heart so they can get taken off by the surgeons when they're not needed anymore. And that means that the atrial wires often have a lot of trouble sensing the atrium. So by default, the setting of the sensitivity for the atrium is almost as sensitive as you can make it. It starts at 0.5. The most sensitive you can make it is 0.4. That's because the pacemaker designers know that it's very likely they're going to have to set it very sensitive in order for it to have a chance of sensing the atrium.
When you're adjusting your output to capture, do you go by the rule where you see the output at which it's like barely capturing and then double it? I'm wondering if this is institutional or universal.
Yeah, so there's a weird thing about pacing where if you are pacing at a certain output, let's say you're pacing at an output of 20 and you want to check a threshold and you start turning it down, you get 19, 18, 17, and you get down to 10 and it stops capturing. So you'd say, all right, it didn't capture a 10, the threshold is 11. And then usually most institutions will double that if they can. So they'd program it at 22. If you started at 5, where it was not capturing, and you start increasing the output, it very likely won't capture at 11.
Interesting.
The thresholds tend to be different when you start low and work your way up versus come down. So by convention, we always start where we're capturing and then come down to see what the threshold is. So generally, I think most institutions will double the output. Or if it's very low, a lot of times we just leave it at 5 as a lower number.
Sure. That sounds great. Yes. How about this follow-up question? Let's shift from this case. Maybe you have a patient who's AAI paced for whatever reason. We come in the room, they're bradycardic. We're going up on the amplitude and all these things. We're not quite sure exactly what's going on, but we know this patient's bradycardic. Should we like revert to a different mode, or is there like an emergency mode that we should be aware of from these pacemakers?
I would say if you're not sure what's going on, the safest mode is probably DDD because you're pacing the atrium and the ventricle. You should be able to make it so they're not bradycardic. If that ends up being too complicated, you could just make a VVI because that's just telling it to pace the ventricle at a specific rate. And they should tolerate that well enough while you're trying to sort out what's going on. So the quickest thing is probably VVI. That's probably the best answer. I think I would say that just plug in the ventricular wire, crank up the output, make sure you're capturing, and then try and sort out what the issue is if it seemed like it wasn't working well before.
And just a quick follow-up question here. When you're at the bedside of a patient who's intermittently capturing, maybe their native rate is competing, maybe they're intermittently capturing because of a sensing issue, can you talk a little bit about the risk of RNT phenomenon and why in those scenarios we need to be careful or we can be reassured?
I think in general, the RNT phenomenon is a very low risk at the outputs that we're pacing at. You know, if you look back years ago, the original pacemakers only paced. They didn't have any sensing capabilities. Right? They would just pace at a specific rate, and they would put RNTs all the time because they weren't sensing. And so if the patient had their own heartbeat, it would just pace. And RNTs were not something that were commonly causing arrhythmias. If you pace at a very high output, there is some risk to it. And permanent pacemakers can pace at a higher output than these temporary ones. So there is some small risk with permanent ones. But even with those, it's very, very low risk. You're going to cause a problem. So I wouldn't even worry about that. I would put that out of your head. In general, we want to try and avoid it because it's cleaner and you shouldn't really be pacing then anyway. But for the most part, it's not really a high risk.
Nice. It's not enough electricity to compete with ventricular repolarization and really mess things up.
Like, right. It would be very unlikely you'd be inducing ventricular arrhythmias.
Nice.
Great. So Dr. Silver, thanks for all of the detail about how to troubleshoot the pacemaker. I do recognize that it is much more complex than we can cover in a half an hour conversation here on this audio-only podcast. Let's say we're in this terrible situation where we're unable to troubleshoot the pacemaker effectively in the moment. We have cardiology and EP coming to help us. What else can we do at the bedside to ensure this patient has adequate heart rate, adequate perfusion?
Yeah, I'd say the answer is the same thing as if somebody comes in with like myocarditis and they don't have pacing wires. You effectively don't have any ability to pace the heart directly. So then you're doing things to try and speed up the automaticity of the heart. So that's medications like isopril, epinephrine, maybe atropine, although we don't always see the same effect with atropine because you may increase the sinus node, but not necessarily the ventricle quite as much. So we tend to think of epi and isopril as our two go-tos. And you could do a bolus dose of epi, or you can start an infusion of things. Sometimes things take a little time to get organized. As you're thinking about medicines, you could also put the Zolpeds on the outside of the chest to use for pacing. Most people don't have much experience with that, right? You may have seen it on the Zol, but if you turn the dial from the cardioversion and defibrillation setting, there's a pacing setting. So you put the pads over the heart. So ideally, you put them on top of where you imagine the ventricle to be. So the same way you would to defibrillate, you could put it on the front and the back if you can get to the back. And then there are two settings. There's output and there's rate. So you'd set whatever rate you think is appropriate, and you start turning up the output until you're capturing. It's not always so easy to tell that you're capturing, though, because you get big pulsations. You're capturing a lot of muscles outside the heart also. So the easiest way is just you're going to have an arterial line, hopefully, in that situation. So really just using that to make sure that you're capturing. Or you can feel the pulse. You're not going to get shocked by feeling someone's arm or leg while you're transcutaneously pacing. However, it's not very comfortable, so you want to make sure the patient's sedated. And if you do it for long stretches, you can get burns on the skin. So it's really a temporary way to try and establish a heart rate while you're thinking about doing other things. And other things could be having the surgeons come and either open the chest, or if the chest is already open, put new temporary wires on so that you can make sure that you can capture consistently.
Sure. And we're not going to forget about good old CPR, just in case.
That's right. That should be on the list too.
Yes.
See, that's why you're the ICU doc.
So, bringing it back to our case, we've been pacing this kid in DDD for a complete heart block. Let's say you determine that this kid's not coming out of it. He's going to be requiring this pacing for a long time. I guess, what is your general strategy in approaching kids who may need more than just a temporary epicardial pacemaker?
It's always hard to do generalizations because there are a lot of specifics that are going to help determine things. But in general, if you haven't recovered conduction by 7 days, your chance of recovering conduction is not very good. So there's no hard and fast number of days, but that's kind of our general thought of how long we want to try and wait to give the patient a chance to recover. The things that would sway us to potentially act earlier are if the patient is dependent on pacing, if they really have essentially no or very, very bradycardic rate, if the pacemaker is not working, or if the wires aren't working well, we may be pushed to have the surgeons go in earlier to put a permanent pacemaker. What the surgeon tells us. So if they say that I was nowhere near the AV node, I am shocked that the patient has heart block, then we often wait longer. The only downside to waiting longer is you're stuck in the ICU and the expense of that and the potential complications from being in the ICU for long stretches. But weighing that against having a permanent pacemaker implanted that you may not have needed, generally will tend to wait longer. And if the surgeon says, I'm not at all surprised, the patient has LTGA, I had to put a patch right there, I couldn't avoid it, then we may be thinking about doing the pacemaker a little bit earlier.
What is the typical lifespan of these wires?
So permanent epicardial wires don't tend to last as long as transvenous wires. And part of that is that we tend to put them in younger kids who are putting a lot more stress on the wires than most people who have transvenous wires. They're growing, they're crazy kids that are running around and falling and doing all sorts of activities. And there's a pretty big variability. There are some kids that fracture wires within a year or two. There are some kids that have the same wires for 15 or 20 years and they worked well over the long term. So in general, the risk is higher, but it's kind of hard to say what the chance for any specific patient is. And we don't really have factors that we know that are associated with fractures. So kids who are very sedentary are probably at a lower risk. Kids who are playing sports and doing athletics, probably at a higher risk. We try and limit them to some degree from doing certain sports that we know are very contact-oriented that would be a higher risk. But I have kids who are pretty sedentary who have come in with lead fractures and were surprising.
On a similar note, what about in the ICU? How long will these temporary wires typically last if we had to push it out a little bit?
That's also very variable, and there's not really much we know that we can do to try and extend the life of the temporary wires. Sometimes people will think about using steroids to try and prevent inflammation. We don't have any data that says that works, but we've tried it on occasion. We do have some kids who have had wires for months. I'm thinking of a few babies who were born very premature who had heart block, where we didn't want to put a permanent pacemaker in, and we chose to put temporary wires in. And we've used them for 6 to 8 weeks or more.
Wow.
But not very common. Most of the time, it's within a few days or so, especially the kids who are a little bit older who are moving around a little more. The chance that the wires are going to get tugged on becomes a little higher. There are times that the wires don't work pretty soon after coming out of the operating room. And there are times that we're fine a week or so out, still waiting to see if the AV node is going to recover.
Great. Alice, you have a couple mini cases for us to reinforce some of this really good knowledge that Dr. Silver's provided us with.
Yeah. So Let me give you a few cases here of maybe the long-term pacing requirement. We've got a three-year-old with hypoplastic left heart coming back to the unit after his Fontan. You notice he's having sinus Brady to the 60s on telly. How would you recommend pacing him?
If you have sinus bradycardia or junctional bradycardia, you want to give them a faster rate. And in order to give a faster rate and provide AV synchrony, AAI would work very well, as long as the AV node is working. If there's any concerns about the AV node not being able to conduct consistently, then DDD would be a better choice. But as long as the AV node is working well, then AAI is very reasonable.
Nice. What about an 8-year-old girl with AFib?
So if you have atrial fibrillation, your atrium is going very, very fast. You don't have to pace the atrium. And you really can't pace somebody out of atrial fibrillation. If it was atrial flutter, you'd have a chance of being able to pace terminate the atrial flutter. But atrial fibrillation, you really can't do that. So if they're particularly bradycardic, or if they have stretches where they have several seconds with no beats, even though overall their heart rate's okay, you could put them on a VVI backup to make sure that they're not going to be too bradycardic. But you probably would be doing things medically or cardioverting to try and fix the atrial arrhythmia if you could.
Great.
I've always found it confusing. Why would you ever pick VVI over DDD, except like for the case we mentioned, but how to differentiate between the, why would you pick that one over the other?
VVI is a real backup, right? If you have somebody who has a reasonable rhythm, but they had heart block in the OR and you're not sure you trust the AV node, you may set them at VVI at 50 just to make sure that if they had sudden heart block, they're not going to get too bradycardic. If you try and set somebody DDD like that, you really can't do that effectively as a backup. You're going to be pacing the ventricle because it's sensing the atrium. Unless you tell it to wait a really long time to give the AV node a chance to conduct, you're very likely going to be pacing the ventricle a lot. And you really can't monitor to see what their conduction is like if you're pacing the ventricle. If they had intermittent heart block, you wouldn't be able to tell because you'd be pacing. So VVI is a good choice as a backup. And VVI is a reasonable choice if you have complete heart block and your atrial wires aren't working. Other than that, if you have heart block, you'd rather do DDD.
Well, Dr. Silver, I really have enjoyed your conversation with us today. I commend you for your bravery tackling this very visual topic of rhythms and EP and skillfully walking us through this in an audio-only format. This is certainly an intimidating topic for critical care fellows who don't have as much exposure to this as I feel like we really want to as we work towards the end of our training and getting that first attending job. I'd like to give you one more open-ended question. Really, it can be anything that you'd like. If you'd like to plug anything, any recommendations for our listeners, or just feel free to reinforce a couple key points from today's conversation.
All right, I have two things. I have a quick plug. There is what's called PACES, the Pediatric and Congenital EP Society. Most people in your world and most people in my world, other than electrophysiologists, probably don't know much about it. But there is some educational content that we try and post on the website. It's not quite as robust as we would like yet, but we're working on it.
Nice.
There's also Heart University that a lot of people in the cardiology world knows that has a lot of educational things on arrhythmias, but also heart things in general. And the other thing I'll say is that most pediatric electrophysiologists, in my experience, are very friendly people, and we love talking about this stuff. So if we're walking through a unit and somebody's being paced and you want a refresher on why the sensing is not working or really any of these things, we'll probably bore you to death over 20 minutes of going through all these things. But we're happy to explain things and talk about things. So feel free to ask questions, especially when you're young and in training. This is your chance. You can ask as much as you want. And nobody's going to fault you. Even when you get old and get gray hairs, you can ask, but it's easier when you're younger. And feel free to ask questions and make sure that you understand what we're doing with the pacemaker and make sure that you know how to troubleshoot if issues come up.
Nice. Well, PACES and Heart University, I just opened the website. They look really nice. And thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Peds Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @CritPeds and @PedsCrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.